Please be seated, thank you. This is a time and place set for oral argument in the matter of Gerald Palelski versus Roger Palelski and Lawrence Palelski. Mr. Mitch Peterson appears for appellants. Mr. Tim Whalen appears for appellees. Mr. Peterson, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Mitch Peterson with the Davenport Evans Law Firm, and it is my pleasure to represent Larry and Roger Palelski. Last name is a mouthful. It took me a few tries. Larry and his wife Alice are here in the crowd. Roger and his wife Sharon were unable to make it. And the other party is obviously their brother, Jerry Palelski, or Gerald Palelski, represented by Mr. Whalen. This case was settled 8 years ago. 8 years ago, after two mediations, substantial written documentation regarding the terms of the settlement agreement, and what persuaded the trial court not to enforce the settlement was Jerry's never-ending arguments over immaterial details, the equivalent of having child custody figured out, the house split up, the retirements, the cash, everything, and then Jerry espouses a disagreement over the proverbial toaster when everything else is done. That's what got in the way that persuaded the trial court, and we believe the trial court erred. We are seeking reversal of that decision.
So, counsel, since you start with the long time span, a lot happened then after that. There was a later order essentially ratifying many of the terms of what you're advocating was the settlement agreement. Property has changed hands. We've had a trial. We now have the court making determinations on the remaining assets, determining a true-up figure, which you've not appealed. So isn't this now moot?
It's not moot, Your Honor, because none of that should happen. I mean, that judgment should not have been entered because the settlement should have been enforced. The issues with the true-up, those always needed to be decided. The agreement was to have those arbitrated. Frankly, I don't know that it matters a whole lot to my clients whether it's about $20,000 in issues from fuel in fuel tanks, chemicals sitting on a counter, ticky-tack little issues that collectively amount to about $20,000.
That's solely what we're here for today is over the $20,000 that's disputed?
We believe that this court should reverse and enforce the settlement. Basically, that would void the jury verdict for $25,000 in Jerry's favor because that was the legal claims, the jury claims were agreed to be dismissed as part of the first mediation and every agreement after that. And then in exchange for the release of $1 million embezzlement claim against Jerry Palelski, he agreed to give Larry and Roger all of the cattle and all of the crops. So the trial court ultimately didn't enforce the release in exchange for the crops and the cattle. So that's the bulk of what the court decided. It'd be very easy for this court to reverse and remand with instructions to have Jerry return the money he got for the jury verdict, the cattle and the crops, because he exchanged that for a release. And what he would keep is just the money for those true-up.
Why is the issue of the release, the settlement agreement, still alive? I mean, this is years ago. Usually our notice of appeal is 30 days.
Well, it wasn't a final decision, Your Honor. So the original motion to enforce was denied approximately 7 years ago. Thereafter, the parties acted as if the settlement happened. The equipment that they agreed to exchange, they used. They stayed out of each other's business. My clients got the crops and livestock. They split up the real estate. They acted as if there was an agreement. So a year later, my clients are like, well, if he's acting like there's an agreement, shouldn't we ask the court to enforce again?
So then I got to get the remedy you're asking for clear in my head. So you're not asking to undo any of those property exchanges that have occurred. It's solely the monetary verdict that you would, your position is that if the settlement was now in, from 7 years ago enforced, we treat this as if there was no jury trial. It should have never happened. So then none of those, the monetary award goes away. What happens with the what was left
so
to resolve then? And then the second part of that is, then I assume under your position here, that also makes your unjust enrichment claim go away as well.
That is correct.
So then there's nothing else.
That is correct. So if the court says there was a deal back 8 years ago and enforces it, it's very easy to figure out because most of the stuff's already been distributed. Nobody's fighting about that. The real estate and the equipment, that's done. It's a done deal. Neither side has taken issue with that. The issue is the crops and the livestock. So the court issued memorandum opinions with line item dollars for each of those items. Jerry should just have to give the money back for the $25,000 jury verdict and the amount awarded for crops and cattle. And, of course, the interest that runs on that.
If the court were to rule today that the settlement agreement is enforceable, does that take care of everything, or are there still things out there?
There would not need to be any further trial or remand other than to implement. Specifically, Your Honor, the court on its partnership dissolution, again, set out line items for, you know, Jerry's share of fuel. All we would need to do is back out the cattle, the crops, and the jury verdict. So Jerry would need specifically to return $314,455 plus the interest from the time that my clients had to pay that about a year ago to satisfy the judgment. But Jerry would retain the approximately, I don't have the exact number, but it's about $20,000 for these ticky-tack true-up items. He would get to keep that. Whether, again, the parties agreed that should have been arbitrated, but we're not going to argue about that over $20,000. The trial court resolved it. We're fine with that resolution. Frankly, the trial court basically agreed with my clients on nearly every single issue on what assets actually existed, what quantities of different chemicals that needed to be trued up, and then the value of those things. So Jerry would just need to return the money for which he was paid for the jury verdict, the cattle, and the crops.
As I assume that some of these, like the machinery and some of the fungible items, no longer exist from 7 years ago.
All of those items have been distributed. The parties are happy with it. Nobody's arguing about equipment. So that's not within any of the remedies that either party seeks. So there wouldn't be a concern about, well, what about all the extra hours on that tractor they got? What if that goes to a different brother? That's not part of what's on appeal. That's distributed. That's handled. Nobody's arguing about it. It's the issues that went to trial.
So then if we get to those, so the circuit court found that there wasn't consent on all the essential terms. And as I see your position is that you're characterizing these as little minor things like the toaster. Obviously, your opposing counsel is going to probably have a different opinion on that. But can you, by what legal authority are you aware where we define the whether or not a term is essential by its monetary value, for example?
I don't think there's a hard and fast line in the sand in terms of what percentage of an overall dispute needs to be decided. Here, I think, you know, ordinarily findings are reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard, but we have a cold record of what Jerry was fighting about. You know, he thought, well, the cattle gates, they weren't fixtures, those should have been separated. Well, it's $1,000.
But wouldn't a party maintain some unilateral autonomy to say, you know, this might be a small thing, but it's important to me, and I'm going to withhold my consent to the whole thing until I get my way on this particular term, which in the scheme of things maybe isn't viewed as being big or valuable. But doesn't a party have a right to withhold their consent?
They do, but it can't come up 6 months later when you want to back out of a deal. That contingent consent was never communicated by Jerry at any point during either mediation or any of the voluminous emails and letters back and forth between counsel. This whole deal was contingent upon every single detail being resolved, was not communicated until late in 2013. This is months after the deal was done, after property was exchanged, after equipment had been exchanged. He then tries to leverage that to get his way on these ticky-tack little items. But so number one, that didn't actually happen here. He didn't make his consent contingent upon that. But secondarily, the parties actually agreed to the extent they couldn't iron out these little ticky-tack issues that were about one half of 1% of the value of the partnership, they would arbitrate the dispute with Lon Gordy. So they agreed for a mechanism, hey, if we can't agree on these things, you know, mom's stained glass window that might be worth $100, but it might have emotional importance. If we can't figure those things out, we will arbitrate it. And that was confirmed by Mr. Cheddar, Jerry's attorney at the time, back in 2013.
Well, but, you know, Mr. Khoury testified at the hearing on whether or not there was an agreement. And my recollection from the transcript of that hearing is the court asked him a very pointed question as to whether that was an agreement or whether there was just a discussion about arbitrating further disputes. And he said it was a discussion.
I think Mr. Corey's testimony on that was he didn't have a clear recollection. At the time he testified, it was a year prior. And the arbitration term wasn't in the settlement memorandums, but it was in the email from Jerry's attorney. And back and forth from the attorneys, that was agreed upon at the second mediation. Mr. Khoury didn't put that detail in the memorandum and was not able to recall that a year later when he was testifying. But the important point is Jerry's lawyer agreed to that, that yes, we did in fact agree to do that.
So does that bind the client, and under what legal authority?
Well, it was Jerry's lawyer saying that Jerry had agreed to it. It wasn't Paul Cheddar agreeing on Jerry's behalf. The parties actually agreed to that in mediation, and that was the recollection of both lawyers who witnessed it that day, that yes, we did agree to arbitrate these immaterial issues that, to the extent the parties couldn't figure it out. With respect to a hard line in the sand, there isn't one in terms of a dollar amount. But after the first, there's about $5 million in partnership property here. There's real estate, equipment, there's a couple $100,000 in cattle, in crops. And there will always be something you could find to say, well, we didn't talk about that rusty wagon wheel sitting out in the pasture, so I guess we don't have a deal. That can't be what the law is. That will absolutely paralyze the practice of law in this state. When parties agree, there's a memorandum, the attorney the next day says, yep, it looks good, except for which list we're going to use, and we end up agreeing to that. We go to a second mediation where we already have 99% of the stuff done. We get another 0.5% done. We agree. If we can't figure out the rest, let's arbitrate it. The attorneys agree or email after that. There's no disagreement about what went down. Jerry simply backed out of this and kept making up things to be fighting about, these immaterial issues that do not vitiate his actual consent to the agreement. He simply had buyer's remorse and wanted to back out of it for whatever reason. And again, the issues were immaterial, not sufficient to get in the way of finding a mutual assent. And even if the issues were material, there was an agreement about how to resolve those, and that was an arbitration. An agreement to let a guy like Jerry just point out the toaster and the fork that's sitting in the back of the cupboard, that, oh, we didn't talk about who was going to get the fork. It will paralyze the practice of law. It's terrible policy to let Jerry get away with this. The facts are clear. The existence of the settlement agreement here is an issue to be reviewed de novo. And we would encourage the court to reverse the trial court and have the trial court implement the settlement agreement. Require no further trial. The math is very easy to do based on the findings that the court has already. I do want to touch briefly on our unjust enrichment claim. In the event the court does not enforce the settlement agreement, we have appealed the application of Latches to the unjust enrichment claim. Latches is applicable when a party has full knowledge of the facts, they delay taking legal action unreasonably, and there's some prejudice to the other party. In this case, number one, I could understand why we can't sue Jerry in 2012 for stuff that happened in 1992. Understand that. That's not what we're here about. The misappropriation claim, those acts took place between 2000 and 2011, in acts that were less than a year before going to court. As a matter of law, how can laches apply to a claim that's not even a year old? The rationale of the trial court is, well, Jerry's been stealing since the 70s and the 80s and 90s, therefore in 2012 you can't sue him for something that happened less than a year ago. That gives him immunity.
But you didn't really plead it as individual acts. You alleged it as an entire continuing scheme, basically, that goes back even, it appeared that it went back even further than 2000, but, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on that. But by what legal authority then can we, when it's a continuing scheme like that is alleged, that we carve out just the last part of it in order to avoid the statute of limitations?
Well, we pled that he misappropriated funds in an amount to be determined at trial. Jerry then moved under the statute of limitation for claims that were more than 6 years, so 2006 back. We said, well, there's certainly, this is a continuing tort. He keeps stealing money month after month and year after year. The trial court rejected that and found it not to be a continuing tort. So the trial court found that these are individual discrete acts of misappropriation that the jury must decide. The statute of limitation issue that went to the jury was when there was sufficient knowledge that a reasonable party would have, you know, notice or discovery of the claim. That's not really on appeal here. What we have is laches at its core is you delayed too long and the other party was prejudiced. As a matter of law, when laches is less than the statute of limitation, I don't know how it can apply, but certainly not within a year or two. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars that were taken at the end as Jerry got more bold in his scheme and his actions. That he's been doing it for 30 years shouldn't be an excuse. That's some sort of estoppel waiver argument, but that's not what the trial court found. The trial court found that we waited too long to sue Jerry. Less than a year can't be too long. I mean, 2-3 years can't be too long. I mean, not when you've got family dynamics and brothers and parents that are around, and it's hard to sue one's brother, but it came to that eventually. The trial court shouldn't have just a one-size-fits-all laches. The trial court should have to make a finding, and there were no findings on prejudice. Zero findings on prejudice by the trial court.
Well, that's assuming we don't pay any attention to the set of findings and conclusions that dealt specifically or more specifically with the unjust enrichment claim, right?
Well, I think there's a couple things there. We've got two conflicting findings of fact and conclusions of law. Both parties presented it, and the court just signed them both. Judge Giles signed Jerry's first. And if you look at Odyssey, about 15 minutes later, Judge Giles ended our findings of fact. So to the extent there's a conflict, I think under 52A in common sense, the intent there was that ours would govern conflicting issues.
So the court directed counsel each to prepare findings and conclusions on the issue on which you prevailed, right? That was what it appeared to me happened here in this record.
The trial court directed, yes, the trial court directed findings and conclusions to be prepared in that manner. What we did is literally line by line, we just took the memorandum opinion. This is exactly what the court decided and put it in there for the various findings. So the court entered that last. There were numerous findings in Jerry's that are not based on the evidence, aren't anywhere, and there's no hint of the issue found in the memorandum opinion.
But is a court, and I understand your argument on that, and that's a factual support type question, but is a court precluded or confined to the four corners of its memorandum opinion and later issuing, preparing findings and conclusions?
No. The trial court is not confined to that.
So even if a party did then present additional fact findings, the court reviewed it, reviewed the record, and decided, yes, I agree that this is consistent with the evidence, the court could still then issue findings and fact that will go beyond its memorandum opinion, couldn't it?
Absolutely. And if what we had here was a rejection of our findings and only signing Jerry's, we couldn't really argue, well, the memorandum decision limits, like, we wouldn't be able to argue that. The issue, though, is the last one signed is our proposal. It was 15 minutes later. And to the extent there's a conflict, I think it has to be read as a modification. In a way to resolve those conflicts, is the judge said, we're right on that. We've been more faithful to what was actually decided, and that's what was entered last. Ultimately, we request that the court reverse the trial court's denial of our motion to enforce the settlement agreement. As previously explained and in our brief, it'd be easy to implement based on the court's findings. Alternatively, we'd ask the court to reverse the application of the doctrine of laches and remand this for entry of judgment on our unjust enrichment claim.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whalen, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, the settlement argument is nothing more than a backdoor to a loss at jury trial. We didn't win. We didn't win with the court trial. Now we want to try to have a settlement that was several years before the trial enforced. That's not proper. Moreover, it's indefensible. 7 years, approximately 7 years of negotiations and back and forth and argument about assets, who got what, when do they get it, how do we divide it up. There's an initial agreement. Then there's a withdrawal of the agreement. Then there's a rejection of the agreement. Then there's further modification of the agreement. The circuit court found appropriately on the settlement issue because it was impossible to arrive at what the terms were. Were some things settled? Yes, they were. And the circuit court recognized that legitimately. It recognized it with regard to the land, and it recognized that with regard to the dissolution of the partnership, and it recognized that with regard to the certain equipment. But then there were sticking issues. Then there were points. There were problems. And those arose after the initial mediation in February of 13. What happened was the mistake that occurred in this case, I came into this matter halfway through it, and I didn't handle any of the settlement issues or any of the mediation. When I came into the case, I looked back, and no discovery had occurred before the parties agreed to go to mediation. Consequently, both parties went in with this concept of, here's what we think's there, and here's what we think's there. So they didn't have a firm grasp on what they were really negotiating. This partnership lasted 30-some years. It was run by three farmers, brothers, who each had their ideas as to how they wanted to operate. Those ideas were not written. They were very loose, and the partnership was conducted in a very informal manner. Consequently, things were run informally, and there wasn't a strict record or a strict calculation or ledger of what everybody did and when and how the money was spent and how the equipment was utilized, and it was a family-run operation. So it was very, very loose and very, very informal. So they try to settle this case. They can't get it done. Once they do that, then Jerry, my client, starts discovering that, wait a minute, certain things that were represented at the mediation weren't as I thought they were. Number one, he found out much later, much, much later, after the both mediations were done, I believe, that there had been $5,000 prepayment on expenses at Potter Tire, and it occurred just days before the beginning of the February mediation. That's suspicious. But he didn't know about that when they engaged in the mediation. He later, at mediation, it was represented to him that all the cattle, the fat cattle, had been sold. He found out later, after the mediations had occurred, that that wasn't true. So he's discovering in the process of this whole case and these settlement negotiations that things aren't as they were represented. So when Mr. Peterson argues that we had this case settled, but it was just a de minimis amount of property that was not taken care of, that is not accurate. From Jerry's standpoint, there are a number of items that were problematic. There were a number of items that he was unaware of. There were things that he was discovering as the settlement negotiations were unfolding. It's important to notice that that after discovery had started, there was a motion to stay the discovery. So, and that motion came several months, I think it was in December, after the 2013 mediations had occurred. So the problem is that you're trying to settle a case when you really don't know what's out there. And then there's allegations or there's information that come to light that you're not getting a full disclosure of what's out there. The hay, was it a moving target? Absolutely. One time it's this, the next time it's this, and then an email comes in and says, no, it's not either, it's this. Then we have another situation where we have the cattle, and we have a disposition of other assets.
Well, counsel, are you suggesting that the case is not complete and that needs to go back to the trial court for further resolution, or are you satisfied?
No, I'm satisfied. That's why there was no notice of review, Justice Gilbertson, is because...
Well, the way you were talking here, I wondered about it.
No, I'll clarify that. My argument is the settlement is null and void. There wasn't any settlement. It's not even appropriate to call it a settlement. The trial is the result. The settlements that were recognized by the circuit court that it approved and granted, those are appropriate. The idea that you go back to the April 23rd, 2013 settlement and implement it and say that settlement is, quote unquote, the true settlement, when in fact it's not, then divest my client of all of the money and the jury award and the court's award at trial. So my argument is no, the settlement is not there. There is not a complete settlement of this case, as Mr. Peterson argues.
I think, you know, if you want to respond to Mr. Peterson's argument, he seemed to acknowledge that, yes, there could be essential terms that may be what one side considers de minimis, the other does not. His argument appeared to be that happened too late, that there was an agreement and it wasn't, I think he said, months later than your client started to backtrack. Explain why that's not a fair characterization of what happened.
Because on March 30th of 2016, there was another agreement that was struck and was ultimately enforced by the court. So the mediation is in 2013, but yet the circuit court enters an order based upon further negotiations and based upon an agreement reached on March 30th of 2016, 3 years later, and that settlement is written and it's signed by my client, and the judge enforces that. And in that settlement, it specifically reserved true-up items, crops, livestock, and other items. So those things were reserved for litigation by the parties. Mr. Peterson's clients sought enforcement of that agreement. The circuit court granted that motion and said that settlement signed by my client was enforceable. Specifically, though, it reserved for trial the issues that were in fact tried to the jury and the court. And that's set forth in paragraph 2 of that agreement. And it's the order that approved that was dated December 8th of 2016, if I recall correctly. And that order is quoted in my brief. And it was also part of what Mr. Peterson's argument was when they made the motion to support or to enforce that settlement. In their brief and in their motion, they indicated that a new settlement was reached on 3/30 of 16, and they sought to enforce that particular agreement. And it reserved those items for litigation. It's incongruous. It's inappropriate to come in and argue and then say we had a settlement back in April of 2013. We reached another one in March of 2016. But now I want to go back and enforce the settlement allegedly reached in April of 2013.
Remind me, please, who went to the court and asked to enforce the 2016 settlement?
The defendants did.
So...
Mr. Peterson's clients.
Okay.
The appellants went back to enforce that agreement and submitted the document as an enforceable agreement.
I don't know that you use these terms, but it almost sounds to me that you're arguing that they should be estopped or judicially estopped, or I don't know if that's the correct characterization or not, but from now coming back and trying to enforce an earlier settlement
I don't know if it's a collateral estoppel or a judicial estoppel, judge or justice, but I look at it from the standpoint that the way I approached this when it was appealed is you're appealing this particular settlement. You're saying the judge was wrong. And I'm saying the judge actually was correct. I'm saying that the judge was correct. His decision was supported by facts. It wasn't erroneous. He followed the law, and the December 8th, 2016 order is in fact that adopts that settlement that my client signed is in fact a correct order, and that's how we proceeded to trial. So I don't know that I could exactly phrase it as an estoppel argument. I think it's more of we're proceeding in accordance with the court's ruling and decision. And so as a result of that, we proceed to trial, and before I move on to the trial issues, I think it's important to note that the law does permit the court to enforce settlement agreements, but it doesn't permit the courts to negotiate those. And that's what Mr. Peterson's clients are trying to do here on appeal. They're trying to have the circuit courts negotiate settlements for parties. And they've piecemealed by this email, by that email, by this statement, by this piece of document. They've tried to piecemeal this together. And the problem with the five motions to enforce that they brought is that the circuit courts did not look at this once or twice or in a vacuum or in isolated circumstances. The circuit court looked at this five times with two different judges. And they ruled as they did, and the final settlement that they claim was reached was never recognized by the court. So after all that consideration and after all those findings of fact and after all those circumstances, I think it's hard-pressed to come in and say, well, we really piecemealed this case together, and any errors or any disputes are de minimis. That's not accurate, as I argued earlier. In addition to that, The appellants are looking at this in hindsight. They're saying, look, we went to trial, and here's what the judge decided at trial. Well, that didn't exist at the time that the mediations were occurring and the settlement negotiations were occurring. Were there other facts that came to light at trial? Well, of course there were. But they weren't part of that mediation, and they weren't part of that settlement negotiation. And I also think it's important to look at the Uniform Mediation Act, not from the perspective that there was an error made by the trial court by listening to Lon Quarry's testimony because he was the mediator. I think what's important in that respect is to look at the analytical thinking of the case. I believe it was the Stockwell, or it was Wingert. If you look at the Wingert case, the rationale of that case, rather than necessarily its holding, is what's important. And the Uniform Mediation Act, one of the intents of that is to keep all of this emails and all the arguments that Mr. Peterson's making from coming to light because it just clouds the issue. Now, I'm not saying that they violated the Uniform Mediation Act. What I'm arguing is that the Uniform Mediation Act should be, the decision under that act should be applicable here and the rationale followed by this court in the sense that we're not going to go back and listen to arguments made in mediation and who said what and what occurred because that is not an issue that we need to address. Now, I want to address the findings of fact and the conclusions of law very directly here. I think it's important to note, and I know this court knows that the law is clear on this, the trial court sits in the same position as the jury on the determination of the credibility of the witnesses and what weight to give their testimony. And in that regard, the trial court can make the decision to accept part of witness's testimony, or if they feel that testimony is not accurate, reject it, but still find credible other portions of that witness's testimony. In addition to that, if the court looks at it and says, well, I don't find this witness's testimony was accurate in any respect, he can't, the judge cannot overlook the clear and uncontradicted evidence. And in this case, the clear and uncontradicted evidence was such that the defendants did not prove their counterclaim, nor their unjust enrichment claim. And that's specifically where the court went and specifically what the court looked at. As far as the unjust enrichment and the manner in which the findings of fact and conclusions of law were entered, there's no error there. There's nothing prohibiting in the law a judge from having one party render findings of fact and conclusions of law on one issue and findings and conclusions on another issue. Is it unusual? Yes. Is it wrong? No. Is it erroneous and reversible error? Absolutely not. And in addition to that, I think the record would show that after the jury verdict and after the court's verdict, there was a motion to reconsider made basically on the same grounds as what is before you today. So Judge Giles had the opportunity to reconsider his memorandum decision and look at it again before he entered the findings of fact and conclusions of law that he did. On the prejudice issue, as far as the unjust enrichment claim, I think that goes hand in hand with the Laches defense. When the court looked at this, the findings of fact are clear that the court referenced the jury's verdict. The jury's verdict was in favor of the plaintiff. The jury rejected entirely the $2 million claim made by the defendants and its counterclaim. The jury said, you didn't prove your case. Judge Giles, consistent with the jury's verdict, said you didn't prove your case. In addition to that, there was an issue of Laches that he addressed. And in deciding the prejudice issue, the position the circuit court took is that as part of the prejudice, you look at who prevailed or who produced credible evidence. And as it was previously pointed out by, I believe, Justice Devaney, was the fact that this occurred over a long period of time. The court, when it reviews this case and the findings of fact and conclusions of law, looks for error based upon the totality of the evidence, based upon all of the evidence and not just a small portion of it or isolated bits and pieces of that evidence. So when Judge Giles made his findings, he clearly looked at what had occurred over the decades-long operation of this particular partnership. And I think it is just so glaring why it clearly Judge Giles determined that there was no unjust enrichment when you look at the actions of the defendant over the years. They claimed Jerry was stealing, but in each circumstance that they claimed he was stealing for the decades, the 2.5 decades that they claimed it was occurring, they gave him the checkbook. He continued to write checks. His activities were unmonitored. He still ran up bills with the various suppliers. When bills came to each of the other partners, Roger and Larry, when they were handling the books, they paid those bills. The expert for the plaintiff testified that over 80% of the checks that comprised the claim of the defendant over the last 6 years, from 2006 to 12, were written and signed by either Roger or Larry. But then they come in and say, there's been an embezzlement, there's been a theft, there's been a misappropriation. Their claim was wholly inconsistent with the facts, and those facts were undisputed. They recognized, they said, they testified, we suspected this was going on back in as early as the late 80s. The Judge Giles recognized that. The findings entered by Judge Giles on the unjust enrichment show that. So the prejudice is more than just that limited by the Clarkson case or by the Young Revocable Trust case or those cases that follow suit. It's more than just what happened to evidence or was this party prejudiced. The prejudice goes is intertwined with whether or not you proved your case. Because if you didn't have a case, there clearly would be prejudicial to allow that case to be argued or to be even presented. And that was the defense that we presented, and that was the arguments we made. Does Laches go hand in hand with you don't have a claim? Absolutely. That's the point of Laches. So to say that it's disingenuous or that you can bifurcate those two issues and you can't intertwine them is absolutely inconsistent with what the law provides. So, again, I think it's clear there's a gross lack of proof in this case. There was absolutely no settlement, global settlement reached, as Mr. Peterson argues.
Mr. Willem, before you sit down on that topic, sorry to interrupt. I know you're wrapping up, and I'll let you do that. But can you help me and direct me to the partial settlement agreement that you talked about earlier? Some time ago, but you recall you had this an argument and said, look, I mean, we had these communications. We didn't reach the global agreement. We did reach a smaller settlement agreement, which my client signed. Recall that?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm taking you back in your argument.
That's okay.
I thought you said it was in March?
No, the settlement agreement was claimed to have been reached in March 30th of 2016. The motion to enforce that settlement was made in September, I believe.
Where's the settlement agreement, and what is the settlement agreement that you indicated that your client had signed? Was it that one about the draft items?
It was called draft settlement agreement. It was signed by my client, and it's attached to the December 6th.
From April 2016 is when your client, I think, signed that. But it's attached as Exhibit A to then-Judge Jensen's order enforcing?
Correct, and I believe that date of that order is 12-8 of 16. I had the reference to the settled record.
I just want to make sure that was the right one.
Yep, that's the order.
Okay, thank you.
And so my conclusion, folks, is it just ain't there. There's just no grounds for reversing this case. There's no reversible error. The findings are clear. There's been no mistake. The case was decided. It was concluded, and it was concluded in favor of my clients. I would urge this court not to allow the defendant to basically take a second shot at the jury verdict and the court's verdict by creating issues where there really are no issues. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Peterson, your rebuttal.
Let's not forget that it is Jerry that backed out of the settlement. We tried to enforce the settlement 5 times, which has to be a record before a circuit court, to try to get the deal put together. To suggest that if we can't enforce the first deal, that we are somehow precluded by later litigation action by making the best of a bad situation would set very bad precedent and very bad litigation practice policy in the state.
The part about the later one, though, that I'd like to key in on, so the 2016 settlement, that, do you agree with Mr. Whalen's comment that it was that you brought that motion to enforce that particular one to the court on behalf of your clients?
Yes. After the full agreement was not done, we negotiated 3 years later this deal with whatever's on your property, you keep it. Whatever's on mine, I'll keep it. And then here's the amount of cash that'll exchange hands.
And the part that I want to key in on that Mr. Whalen pointed out is that contained a reservation of certain claims that would go to trial. And if you are the advocating for the court to enforce that, how do you, and then that happened, the rest of it did go to trial. How do you now come back to the court and say, no, we want to undo all of that, or that particular provision of that settlement?
The particular provision is the true-up provision, that whatever needs to be trued up, that will be decided by the court. It remained our position then, before, and today, that the only true-up items are the items listed in the findings of fact and conclusions of law other than crops and livestock. Now, Jerry disagreed with that, so we agreed whatever rights are there, whatever needs to be decided, is going to go be decided by the court. Again, that was 3 years after the fact when Jerry had backed out of the settlement agreement to preclude further negotiation at risk of not being able to enforce what a party thinks was a deal to begin with would be bad policy for this state. Parties ought to be encouraged to try to continue to work things out, and you shouldn't just have to say, I refuse to participate, enter final judgment against me so we can appeal the denial of the settlement back in 2014. Everybody made the best of a bad situation in this particular situation, and there's certainly no admission there that those rights exist. It's whatever needs to be trued up will be trued up. And that's basically the sum and substance of the 2016 agreement. A few issues here that came up. Another thing on that, if Jerry's position is, look, if the court does enforce the mediated settlement agreement, I wouldn't have done that 2016 deal. He could have noticed that for review to say, in the event the court agrees with enforcing the settlement agreement that's in writing, that everyone testified to, the jury changed his mind about later, I wouldn't have made certain decisions. If that's his position, he could have noticed that for review if he wanted to, and he didn't.
Did the 2016 agreement recite in some way that you weren't relinquishing, and I'm not saying it had to, but it did recite that you weren't relinquishing your previous arguments that there had been a global resolution, but notwithstanding that, you were pressing on to do what you could do.
Very, and this is page 111 in our appendix. It's a one-page agreement. Well, there's a backside that's signed, but the agreement is about dividing up included property. And included property has a definition of everything that's at Jerry's place and Brian's place, you keep it. Everything that's at Larry and Roger's, they keep. Except we excluded property, say we're not, this is not applicable to certain things, including any equipment that already changed hands under the prior court order. And it's not applicable to any other rights the parties may have with respect to true up or the jury claims. That was written as an exclusion from what was being agreed to. So I think that's an important context to take a look at that. And as part of it, then we paid Jerry $14,500 because we had a little more junk on our property than he did, and that's what they agreed would be a fair number to balance out. But that gives you the nature of this is a $14,500 agreement in a $5 million partnership. But this is really indicative of the kind of ticky-tack issues that persuaded the trial court not to enforce an agreement over 99.5% of the partnership assets. It's a little over 99.5% if one does the math. And it takes years to sort out who's going to keep wagon wheels because Jerry keeps backing out of it. Even when he signs the agreement, we have to take him to court. I'll save my frustration for a drink over a beer sometime, but it's very clear that it's in writing, it's in our appendix, it's the Loncourt memorandum. The only items here that actually went to trial, there's three issues. There's the cattle and the crops, there's the release of claims, and then there's the true-up issues on the smaller items. Those are the three things. After all of the times that we tried to continue to negotiate, the five times that we tried to enforce the settlement agreement, what ultimately made its way to court last January were those three issues: the jury claims, the cattle and the crops, and the true-up items. And the true-up items, those are the items where the parties agreed to arbitrate, we'll live with Judge Dial's decision. If you look at his findings of fact and conclusions of law, there's a little chart, I think it's finding number 60. It lists all the different true-up items and the dollar amounts. So if you say, no, Jerry, you don't get the livestock, the bees, and the crops because you agreed to trade that for the release, you can back that out, and he keeps the money for those ticky-tack items that had to be resolved. But the language of Mr. Corey's settlement agreement that Mr. Tobin said everything looks good, that was then reaffirmed, readopted in the April mediation, say, yes, everything looks good there. Now we're talking about some new stuff. We go for months thereafter where there's no objection to it. We keep talking about these true-up issues, trying to get everything done so we don't have to arbitrate. And when we hit a brick wall on the proverbial toasters, then Jerry says, well, my consent was contingent upon every little tiny detail being worked out. And I had a misunderstanding. I think you lied about the hay bale count, so I didn't get what I thought I had coming. Those are all things the trial court rejected as part of its findings later in the court. But we've got written documentation, emails from attorneys following up, we have testimony from the mediator, and we have no genuine disagreement about what the settlement terms are. This needs to be enforced. And it's not that you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. Because of the nature of the findings and the conclusions on the true-up issues, it makes it very easy for the trial court to implement this with a simple exercise of mathematics. We'd encourage the court to do that and set good policy in this case. There's a reference to the Uniform Mediation Act for the reasons cited in our brief. Those should be rejected. There was never an objection to the testimony or the evidence at the trial court level. There was never, that issue was never brought to the circuit court, and it wasn't part of a notice of review. So it's been waived in every possible way you can waive an argument. So that should be ignored in this case. So the parties agreed to present that evidence to the trial court. Briefly on the Latches defense, too. Latches, it's an affirmative defense. So if we didn't prove our claim, why wouldn't the trial court have just said that in the memorandum opinion? Judge Giles didn't. He said, you lose because of the application of laches. It's an affirmative defense. You don't get there unless your claim is proven. That is the nature of an affirmative defense. And he made clear in the latest version of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, which is the version that Larry and Roger submitted, that make clear that it's not that the claim wasn't proven, it's that laches applies to deny the claim. That is the procedural record.
There is nothing, though, that says the court has to rule that way, is there? Decide if there is a clear affirmative defense, a court could find that without addressing the underlying, was it proved, the unjust enrichment?
Well, that would be, I suppose, an issue for remand to say, no, circuit court, laches doesn't apply because it can't apply to stuff that just happened a year ago or 2 years ago. So ignore that, enter new findings or new conclusions or relief. And again, this is only if the settlement is not enforced.
But your whole argument also seems to be premised on this notion that we should ignore the findings and conclusions that the court did actually sign on the unjust enrichment, the merits of the claim.
I see my time is out, but I'd be happy. Again, we would encourage the court to look at the modified and the most recent version of those as the best evidence of what the trial court actually decided.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We're adjourned.